You are about to witness history in the making. Despite the world's highest living standards, the average American remained vaguely discontent, aware that his goal of a better way of life had still not been fully realized. There was something missing.
There's this awful gap in our lives just because we don't have... Oh, but why talk about it?
It's just that... Oh, I keep hoping someone can find a way to...
Don't be a fool, Mary. You know that's impossible.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
Gad, it's ironic. With all our technology and industrial know-how, we still don't have the one thing that could give us a better way of life.
It's the Forgotten Filmcast.
When Jack leaves the house with a lady, it's ladies first. Yes, even with his sister.
And welcome to episode 176 of the Forgotten Filmcast. My name is Todd Liebenow, and thanks for joining me for this look at the movies that time forgot. On this episode, I'll be joined by Richard Kirkham from the Lambcast to discuss a 1975 film that was a passion project for an Academy Award-winning director after he won Best Picture. Starring Robert Redford, Beau Svenson, and Susan Sarandon, directed by George Roy Hill, it's The Great Waldo Pepper. But first...
When the teacher calls on him, George just can't seem to remember things that he really ought to know. George doesn't realize it, but his main trouble is...
The Forgotten Film Cast.
Yum, yum. It's time for a tasty and refreshing snack. Promise to satisfy your hunger, your thirst, your sweet tooth. So visit our refreshment center now. Let's go! Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time soon to be released. Drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
Here comes the Doll Squad, America's newest and deadliest secret weapon. A rocket is sabotaged. Oh, this sets the scene for one of the greatest manhunts in the history of the United States.
What's the name of the island?
Meet Sabrina Kincaid, the leader of the Doll Squad, played by redheaded, beautiful Francine York. She recruits members of the Doll Squad from every class of society. Sabrina's code prefix is 0038-2435.
You're just still there. No, I couldn't take you with me if I couldn't trust you, could I?
Of course not. Because the minute you turned your back, I'd kill you.
Oh,
A madman, Eamon O'Reilly, brilliantly portrayed by Michael Ancera, plots the overthrow of the entire world.
Damn it, Maria! Jealousy drives me insane. My love, the time has come.
The enemy is tough, but the Doll Squad is tougher. Their destructive tactics range from the blasting of a 45, the deadly blade of a dagger, the deadly spit from a lethal silencer. Or their slashing hands. Bloody kung fu, judo. The Doll Squad wrote the book. Spelling death and devastation to those who stand in their way. Their will. They work and kill for Uncle Sam. Excitement, for thrills that mount and overwhelm you, for 101 breathtaking minutes that explode on the motion picture screen in a staggering, overpowering spectacle. Don't miss The Doll Squad. Total entertainment for all ages. Be sure to see the Ted V. Michaels film production of The Doll Squad.
Rides a horse. When you've waited 15 years to find a man, it's a shame you can only kill him once. Who killed five defenseless people made one big mistake. They should have killed six. Ever since he was a little boy, there was one thing he always wanted to do: find four men and kill them.
And now, on with the show.
And you could tell it was Kessler because he had a black and yellow plane. It had three wings and looked like a wasp.
That could sting you, you mean?
And he had... Right.
Oh?
And he had the name of his girlfriend, Lola, painted alongside of the plane.
Honest.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. That would have been the highlight of my life, seeing my very own name flying through this. Oh, there's Axel. Hi, Axel. My goodness, he's hurt himself again. Poor thing. Axel, what happened to you?
Oh, it's a long story.
Oh, no, don't tell me. I'd be too upset. I want you to meet a friend of mine, though. He's a pilot, too, and he's been telling me one exciting thing after another. Waldo, this is Axel. Axel, this is Waldo Pepper.
Smile, son. Never disconcert the masses.
Oh, why don't you sit down, dear? Oh, I can't hardly believe it. Me sitting here with two aces. Well, why don't you tell him about when you fought the black and yellow German one?
No, he wasn't black. He wasn't black and yellow, Mary Beth. This plain one.
That's right. And it had Lola written on it. Lola was Kessler's truest love.
Ernst Kessler?
Mm-hmm. And
you Lola. Fought Ernst Kessler?
He sure did. And was it ever exciting? Just wait to hear. Go ahead, tell him, Lola.
Oh, later. Later, maybe.
No.
Hey, no.
Do it, Waldo. Kessler could have killed Waldo, but he let him go on account of Waldo's guns jammed. See, when Kessler and Waldo tangled, Kessler had such respect for Waldo that he just gave him a salute and off he went.
That must have been some thrill.
Well, it went by so fast. But looking back on it, I guess I'd have to say it was kind of exciting.
Oh, he's just being modest, Axel. That was a very dangerous thing. See, that German had already shot down 4 other planes before Waldo could stop him.
Landis, Schwab, Kurt, and McKinnon.
Right. And how did you know?
Because they were with me and the 14th Scouts, Marybeth. And when they took off that morning, I didn't see any Waldo Pepper taking off with them.
He didn't.
There were 5 of them in the flight. Kessler shot down 4 of them, but he let the flight leader live. His name was Captain Frank Madden. He died in combat only a couple of months later.
I don't get it.
You've been sitting here with a four-flusher, Marybeth. He's been telling you stories and getting you drunk so he can work his way with you.
Should have been me.
Okay, our movie this time is The Great Waldo Pepper from 1975. And joining me to discuss this film is Richard Kirkham from the Lambcast. Richard, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Todd, and hello to all of your listeners. I hope you're doing well, and I know that we're going to be having a good time talking about this movie.
Absolutely. Well, but you've been on the show many, many times. In fact, I've gone back and forth on this, I think, between you and Jay, the previous host of the Lambcast. You guys are the record holders, I think, for most appearances on this show. But for the folks that did not hear those wonderful episodes, please remind them who you are and what you do.
Well, as Todd mentioned, I'm the host of the Lambcast, which is the official podcast of the large association of movie blogs. And we do a weekly podcast with a variety of bloggers and podcasters about all kinds of subjects, sometimes current movies, sometimes older things, and what's ever on people's minds. And I've been blogging myself since 2010 at my site, Kirkham A Movie A Day, and I do various projects along the way. I hooked up with Todd the first time when I was in the middle of a project for one of our favorite movie years, 1984. So I had a whole blog that I did for a year called 30 Years On. So you can guess it was 2014. We were talking about – I talked about all the movies I'd seen in 1984 and wrote posts on all of them. And, you know, just like I said, whatever project happens to interest me at the time, that's where I'm going. And it just coincides that the film we're talking about today lines up and synchronizes with a project that I'm doing on my own site this year.
Yeah. We'll talk about that more in a bit here. But I'm always thrilled to have Richard on the show. Like I said, I've had him on many times, and that's no accident because I think Richard's a great guy. I love talking with him, and he's probably one of the people that I've podcasted with the most in this world because of the Lambcast. You know, when I look at all the people that I've come into contact with through these many years of podcasting and blogging and such, I'm in my own little corner of the world here in my basement in Colorado doing this. So I've met very few of these people in real life, including Richard. We've never met in real life, but I consider Richard to be a very good friend. We've connected over the years, and just being able to podcast on a fairly regular basis through our various shows, it's always a great thrill. I feel like every time I sit down to talk with Richard that I'm talking to a great friend, and that's a lot of fun.
That's definitely the truth, and I appreciate that, Todd, because I feel the same way.
Excellent. Now, I know in recent years you've had a change in your life. You've moved to Texas from California. And I know that having been in the Los Angeles area, the Hollywood area, that that's maybe a different kind of culture when it comes to movie watching than you know, making the switch to Texas. I mean, I've thought from time to time, I remember Richard used to tell me, oh, he never missed going to see Lawrence of Arabia on the big screen, which I'm sure is like an annual occurrence in Hollywood. But in Texas, are you getting that same kind of fulfillment?
I won't say it's exactly the same, but I will say I have run into Lawrence of Arabia on the big screen every year that I've been here, and I've been here 3 years now, so
awesome.
I can't complain about that too much. And we lucked out this last year because Jaws was released in a 3D version, so it was playing on a bunch of screens as well. And always Jaws on a big screen is another one of my annual traditions, trying to find that someplace. There are a lot of events here in the because I live in a town right outside of Austin, and so in the Austin area, there are a lot of film events. We don't have quite as many, and we don't always get the guests that they manage to have. But I've done a couple of things that I've enjoyed. I went to a William Shatner event a couple of months ago, and a year and a half ago, I saw Bruce Campbell at an event at the Paramount Theater, which is the, I guess you would call it the traditional movie palace in the city that runs all of the older films on a regular basis. So I've managed to do that, and don't tell anybody, but I sneak back to Southern California three times a year to do something.
So, I mean, you mentioned Lawrence of Arabia, you mentioned Jaws as being ones you always hit on the big screen. Are there some other ones like that that are like just, I if it's on the big screen, I've got to see it?
Yes, absolutely. I think I've seen The Thing on the big screen here in Texas four times since I got here. You know, the John Carpenter version of The Thing is one of my favorite horror films.
Now, that begs the question, though, Richard, because, you know, famously not many people saw that on the big screen when it opened. So are you one of those people?
I am. I saw it on the big screen at the Cinerama Dome. It was basically the film that followed E.T. at the Cinerama Dome. And it did no business. I think it was there for 2 weeks, and then I think E.T. came back.
Yeah. E.T. pretty much ruled the day that song.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Well, excellent. Now, before we hinted on kind of the fact that we are focusing on a certain year here, because you've got a project going on your site right now where you're focusing on movies of 1975. And this movie we're going to be talking about is from 1975. And like you said, we originally connected because of our mutual love for 1984 movies, which, you know, is still my favorite year. But there's those other years that jump out as well. And 75 is clearly one of those years for you. Tell us what it is about 1975.
Well, in 1975, I was a senior in high school and starting college. So it's a transition year for me. But it also is the point of time when, look, I had my own car. I was able to make decisions on my own about what I was going to see. So I got to make a lot of those kinds of choices. And there are just a fantastic bunch of movies that came out in 1975. We've talked about Jaws. That's a 75 film. The Man Who Would Be King, which we did as a podcast on the Lambcast last month, came out in 1975. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. There's just a ton of these movies that if you looked at a list of movies from 1975, you'd say, holy criminy, I can't. When you think of the 1970s and you think of the great films, it would seem like 40% of them came from 1975. Mm.
Yeah, it's quite a year, and it's one that, you know, when I look back, I mean, I was much younger. not trying to be mean there. my summer of freedom was 89, you know, so, but 75, I was 4 years old. But, you know, there's so many movies that, you know, just in my development as a movie fan, you know, from 75, you know, when I got around them, it's like, oh, well, I remember that experience. You know, I remember seeing Cuckoo's Nest for the first time, Jaws for the first time, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, the Rocky Horror Picture Show, Nashville, you know, Tommy. Those are films that, you know, jump out at me as memorable experiences seeing them for the first time. So yeah, 75 is definitely a year worth examining, I think.
Yes, and it made it easy because my project is basically a Throwback Thursday's post, and so I'm going to have at least 52 entries on it. And there are 52 movies easily worth talking about that I saw either in 1975. I would say I saw about 90% of the films I'm going to be talking about in the theater in 1975. There are a few that I've picked up along the way since then, and there are even a couple that I had never seen before that I'm going to be talking about on my project.
Well, I appreciate you disrupting your schedule, if that was the case, so that we could insert this movie into the Forgotten Filmcast schedule. So let's get on to this. This is The Great Waldo Pepper from 1975. This is directed by George Roy Hill, who is a director of many memorable films. Some of them that jump out are things like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, The World According to Garp, Slapshot, which I know is a favorite of Richard's,
yes,
and one of my all-time favorite films, The Sting, of course. I mean, when I think back, again, you know, those memories we have around certain movies, I remember very clearly back when we got our first VHS machine at Christmas 1983, and my parents, being very smart, said, well, we can't just get a machine and not have anything for the family to watch on Christmas. So they went to the video store and they picked up four movies for us to watch over the course of the next few days. And I remember all four of them. They were Blazing Saddles, Bullet, It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, and The Sting. And The Sting has since become one of my all-time favorites. And of course, you know, it's iconic. It was a Best Picture winner, and George Roy Hill won the Oscar for directing that one. So this film is very much kind of the, you know, the passion project that you get to do as a filmmaker,
yes,
after you've had huge success, because this was something that I guess George Roy Hill had been wanting to do for some time. It was a subject matter that he connected with. And so as kind of his reward after The Sting, he got to do this film. He wrote the story for this, but the screenplay credit on this is also a big name. It's William Goldman, who, of course, wrote Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, also All the President's Men, and a little flick for you 80s kids like me called The Princess Bride. So, yeah. But anyway, this film, it begins in 1926, Nebraska, and it centers on a barnstorming former World War I flying ace named Waldo Pepper, played by Robert Redford. And he basically goes from small town to small town. He flies in, draws a crowd, and then he gives people airplane rides in his biplane for $5 a pop. And, you know, he tells all the local stories about, you know, his war adventures, his encounter with the famed German ace Ernst Kessler, you know, things like that. So really gets all the people excited about the airplane and his stories and all that kind of stuff. So now one day, Waldo Pepper encounters another pilot trying to kind of weasel in on his territory, a guy named Axel Olsen, played by Bo Svenson. And at first the two kind of butt heads, but eventually they kind of come to see that they might be an advantage if they work together. So the two then set out to create a death-defying act for a flying circus. It's run by a guy named Doc Dillhofer, played by Philip Bruns. And so Waldo and Axel and Axel's girl Mary Beth, who's played by Susan Sarandon, essentially join this flying circus. You know, I mean, think of it as like, you know, it's a circus, but with airplanes instead of like elephants. Okay. So, and they're doing all kinds of, you know, crazy stunts and things, wing walking and trick flying and all that kind of stuff. Now, meanwhile, Waldo's got a buddy named Ezra, played by Edward Herman. He is working on developing a high performance monoplane as opposed to a biplane, so that Waldo can perform a stunt that nobody has done before, an outside loop. Now, not to give too much away here at the beginning, I'm sure we'll get into some spoilers as we move on, but basically our heroes then kind of experience a degree of success and fame, but at the same time, tragedy strikes multiple times, in fact, and Waldo's flying career gets sidelined. And then we pick up a few years later where we find him in Hollywood, where he ends up getting into the movie business as a stuntman and ends up having an actual encounter with the German ace Kessler, as a movie about his life is being made. So, as I said earlier, this was a bit of a passion project for Hill. He had actually been a pilot himself during both World War II and the Korean War. And as a matter of fact, when it came to the making of this movie, he actually is doing some of the flying for the aerial sequences in this movie. And it has some wild aerial sequences. I'm sure we'll get to that in a moment. But I'm going to let Richard start us out here. Give us a few of your thoughts on The Great Waldo Pepper.
Well, I like Waldo Pepper because, first of all, it's a nostalgia piece for anybody who didn't live in that era. And you get a chance to see, to a large degree, what it was like before people flew on a regular basis. Nowadays, we think of getting on an airplane like you're getting on a bus or a train. It's not that big a deal. Everybody does it on a regular basis. But in 1926, regular commercial air travel didn't exist. And so the opportunity to fly was really something that would be unique. It would be something to tell your family, to share an experience with the world later on. And so that's how a barnstormer like this could land in a town in the Depression era. This is, of course, set right before the Depression starts, but in the 1920s. And for $5, which is not a small amount of change in 1926, get people up in the air because they were going to be getting a pretty unique experience. And the persona of Waldo Pepper is not too unlike the characters in The Sting. He's a little bit of a con artist, because he's not stealing from anybody, but he does tell stories, and he exaggerates and elaborates, and he finds ways to get the farmers and the town folk that he encounters to both trust him, give him assistance, and believe some of the things that he's telling. And it's an interesting character as a result. I don't think that it keeps the same light tone that The Sting had for the most part. I mean, there were serious elements to The Sting. Let's face it, Robert Shaw's character is a murderous gangster, and so there is death hanging over what's going on. But as I recall, there's only one character that we give a darn about that is murdered, and that happens early in the film.
Right.
In this film, there's a lot more death and tragedy, and so I think the tone doesn't quite follow up on that, you know, sort of lighthearted Sting attitude. And that's one of the reasons that the film didn't quite succeed as well as it could have. It should have been a bigger hit, but the tone is, I think, a little bit more elegant and sad, and just, you know, one of those things that's maybe not straight entertainment for people. Although I think it's a very entertaining film. And the flight sequences are terrific. There is something we'll talk about a little bit later about most of the film that I think is kind of different and a little awkward. But we'll wait on that for a moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm in agreement with you about the tone of things. It is different. It turns really dark, and I'm sure we'll get into that in a bit here, but it actually kind of goes back and forth, I thought. You know, as it began, I thought it did have that kind of lighthearted, fun spirit tone that The Sting does. And, you know, so that's kind of why, as it moves to the second act and it does turn pretty dark, that was a pretty shocking shift. But I wouldn't say that the film is uneven in that way. You know, a lot of times when a film kind of jumps back and forth like that, it can be a strange and jarring experience. And I think that Hill handles it pretty well in this film. It jumps back and forth between a more fun, lighthearted tone to something a bit more serious. And he pulls it off very, very well. Jumping back to what you were saying initially about kind of the look at a past era that neither of us were around for, I think that's really great in this movie. And I think that's one of the things that George Roy Hill as a director does very well. I mean, you see that same kind of appreciation for the past in a film like The Sting, in a film like Butch Cassidy. And you're getting that same type of thing here where you feel like you're really there, basically. I mean, there's some films that try to do a period piece, try to take us back to a previous era where you say, okay, that's fine, but it's Hollywood, it's artificial. This feels very real to me.
Yes, it does. And I think, you know, it's the usual techniques that they have in Hollywood. They've got great costuming. They found the right props for the film. I'm not an aviation expert by any stretch of the imagination, and I don't know exactly how authentic all the planes were. But I'll tell you what, Waldo's plane looks like it would be something definitely from the 1920s. It doesn't look like it was something that was refitted from later periods to fit that time era. It looked like a biplane of the World War One era that was still being used.
Well, the planes look, I mean, almost homemade to a certain extent. You know, they very much, when you see the close-up shots of them, especially Axel's plane when you first see it, it really looks like, you know, he's like digging through stuff in a junkyard and threw this thing together. And I don't know a lot about aviation history either and you know, how realistic that is, but I certainly bought it. It looks like these are just a couple of guys who have some experience flying, you know, be it through the war or whatever. And so now they figure, well, I'm going to use that to make some dough. And they cobble together a plane somehow and hit the road.
Yeah, and I think that, well, I'm a sucker for the idea of a circus in that era or a carnival traveling. Or vaudeville acts, and this is kind of a combination of all of those sorts of things, because you get a little bit of a ringmaster effect with Waldo pulling in the crowds to ride on the plane, plus you've got everybody on the ground watching what's going on. And when they get to the circus, the flying circus, there's an element of danger that, you know, let's face it, one of the reasons that people go to car racing is because cars crash and there's a dangerous element to it. And that's really one of the things that you see in this film. And like we said, there's a couple of depressing elements to that.
Yeah. I thought the flying circus sequences were a lot of fun. And as I was watching them, I was also thinking, I'm sure Richard is enjoying these sequences too, because I know how much you enjoy like great character actors and, you know, kind of just the colorful characters that make up a sequence like this. And when you've got, you know, this guy that runs the show and he's kind of like the ringmaster for it. He's got the megaphone and that kind of thing. Yeah. He does the big introductions. And those are great little parts in this. And the other flyers, we don't see a whole lot of them, but we see little bits and pieces. We get bits of, you know, what they do for these different acts. I mean, even as far as like, you know, you've got these grown men who are pilots, you know, dressing up as women for some of the sequences to be able to do like, you know, this little play essentially. And the woman is in danger, the damsel in distress type of thing. And it just, you know, paints a bigger picture, you know, for this flying circus. And that I thought was a lot of fun.
Yeah. There's a lot of the theatrical element in what they're doing, and that's always great. And of course, when they get to Hollywood, there's even more of that.
Yeah. Well, the Hollywood sequences are great too. I thought that was a great look at that era of movie making. Well, let's talk a little bit here about kind of our characters and stuff going on. I mean, one of the things at the heart of this film is this dynamic between Waldo and Axel, which I thought was really great. And doing some reading on the film, it looks like this was originally the hope of George Roy Hill was to reteam Robert Redford and Paul Newman, that right. Redford was going to play Waldo Pepper and Paul Newman was going to play Axel. They didn't go that direction. Paul Newman ended up turning down the role. And I think it would have been a very different film if you had had Paul Newman in that role. I like the dynamic between Waldo and Axel. They're two very different characters, I think. And I'm having a hard time picturing Paul Newman in the Axel role because, for one, I was just so charmed by Bo Svenson. But, you know, I don't know, the way that Axel is in this film doesn't fit Paul Newman.
Well, I think that they would have had to maybe punch up his dialogue a little bit and give him a little bit more story also. I could see why Newman would be a little hesitant to take the role. First of all, it's almost a secondary role, you know, where Waldo Pepper is clearly the star of the feature, and Axel is off screen for a couple of periods of time. But the byplay between them, I could see working really well, like it did in The Sting and Butch Cassidy, especially Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, because there's kidding relationship where they tease one another and make jokes about each other's strengths and weaknesses, and you get a lot of that in this film itself. But I thought Bo Svenson was great. You know, he stepped in. He's an interesting looking actor. I think he looks a little bit different nowadays. I remember seeing him in the Kill Bill films. He's the preacher that marries the bride to her soon to be dead husband. He's been around for a long time. And he looked a little bit, I would say, he looked very farmer-like in this period of time.
Yeah.
As opposed to being more military-like later on, which I think, by the way, he did quite a bit of those kinds of war films. I think he was in the original Inglourious Basterds as well as the Tarantino film.
He's in both of them, I think. Yeah. Well, and I think he's a great contrast to Redford because, I mean, this is your typical type of Robert Redford kind of role for this era. We keep on mentioning The Sting, and I think, you know, there's certainly a lot of similarities between his character here and his character in The Sting. He's this brash, handsome, confident young guy, doesn't necessarily always think things through as much as he should, just live for the moment type of guy. And whereas I think Axel, he's a bit larger. This sounds bad, but he's a bit more awkward looking character. He's very just kind of rigid and matter of fact, and he's just a very,
he's more grounded in the era.
Yes. He's a much, much different type of character than what Redford is playing here. And so when the two start working together, I think that's really a great dynamic. And I love the first scene where they meet each other up, where Redford's kind of flying around. He spots some commotion going on in this other plane, and he goes down and inserts himself into Axel's, you know, attempt to make some money doing trick flying and such. And, there's just already from the beginning there a great butting of heads between these two characters. And in some ways I was, as that sequence was coming to a close, I was like, well, Waldo's kind of a jerk.
Oh, yeah. You know? I mean, he basically put Axel in danger and it resulted in his a pretty severe injury. It could have even been deadly.
Could, yeah.
What looks like it might be a prank, but it was a dangerous prank to be playing. And I thought Axel got over it reasonably well. I'd have been a little bit more hot under the collar.
Yeah. There's kind of there's another figure between the two that I think helps smooth the relationship between them, of course. And that's Susan Sarandon's character, Mary Beth, who I got to admit, I thought was one of the highlights of the movie. And I'm not someone who tends to gravitate too much to Susan Sarandon performances. She's a fine actress. But there are sometimes where I find her a little annoying. You know, I don't always find myself appreciating her maybe as much as other folks do, though the more I see some of her early performances, I'm really charmed. And this is very early for her. I mean, you know, I think a lot of times I think of her first breakout as being the Rocky Horror Picture Show, which is this same year. This is early in her career, and she really shines in this quirky little part, I think.
I think Rocky Horror and this film were the two films that gave me my massive crush on Susan Sarandon. I've always thought that she was just a beautiful woman, and she's got a personality that on screen works really well for me. I've not seen performances from her that I disliked. I know that there are some films that she's made that I didn't care much for, but I've always thought that she was fine. She you know, basically plays an innocent in this story, somebody who is a little naive, but is a good-hearted person who kind of gets swept in by all of the enthusiasm that these two guys have for the flying, and it becomes a point of future guilt as to what happens with her. And yeah, you know, it was a surprise for most people who saw this film the first time and said, wow, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah. And we'll get to that here in a bit, because we never shy away from the spoilers on this show. We're talking about a movie that's almost 50 years old. Yeah. So we'll get to that in a bit. But yeah, we'll save it for a little bit. But yeah, Sarandon is very good in this. And one of the things, too, I really appreciated about her character, you know, she's introduced, you know, you think, okay, this is the love interest for Redford. You know, we've got this little flirtation that's going on in the movie theater, which is a very charming scene.
That's a terrific scene where he kind of inserts himself with her in the movie theater by playing up like he's the hero and he's doing all the things. Here's what I would do. And then, of course, the guy does it on screen. And you just go, now, either he understands the tropes really well or he's seen this movie before.
Yeah, and I love that. I mean, you could just tell by her expression that it doesn't even occur to her that maybe he's seen the movie already.
Right.
You know? But, yeah, it's set up like this is going to be the love interest. But it doesn't end up being that way. She's with Axel, and it and I'm thinking, okay, so it's going to be a love triangle. Fine. No, that's not the way it goes. And I was like, well, that's not what I expected. But hey, that's great. I love it when you surprise me.
Well, then you would be really surprised when his love interest does show up.
Well, yeah, and I gotta say too, one of the big surprises was how underused the actual love interest is for Waldo Pepper, which is played by Margot Kidder, which, you know, again, it's like, all right, well, I'm expecting a certain something then here, but she's hardly in the movie.
Just a little bit. And it's kind of odd because she is his buddy's sister. And when they go back to the house where he lives and she lives, that's really when they kind of step away from all of the activity that the movie's about, and it's a different kind of feel to the movie. And so I think that's one of the reasons that her part is not as significant. And it was never suggested that this was an important relationship. It was a casual relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's, before we move on to, I want to talk about some of the flying sequences. And of course, we want to get into some spoilers here. But before we do that, I'm sure you're chomping at the bit to talk about some of the other great character actors that are in this, because there's a lot of colorful characters that have small parts in this that really just help, you know, paint a brighter picture in this movie.
Yeah. I think we mentioned a little bit Edward Herrmann before. It's surprising to me. I went back and looked at his filmography, and I had thought that he was a slightly bigger star at that point. And in truth was, it's relatively early in his career. He had been in the movie the year before with Redford, The Great Gatsby. And so he's got a good part there. I always remember him from the Roosevelt movies that he made in the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought those were before this, but they weren't. They were after this. So
he plays Roosevelt in Annie too, right? In
yes.
The
Yes. And then I've been writing about 1975 films. I've written about two films that this actor has appeared in. This is the third one for my project this year that he appears in, and it will not be the last one. Jeffrey Lewis, who most people would know from all the Clint Eastwood films, he's a terrific actor, and he plays a part here that's not a big part, but it's one of those ones that you can say, okay, he's not the villain of the piece, but he represents the authority.
Right.
In the story, and which is odd because that's not usually the part he plays, although when he shows up in The Wind and the Lion later on, it is.
Well, like you, I love whenever I see Jeffrey Lewis pop up in something. You know, he's just one of those great, colorful character actors that is always going to deliver something interesting. And he's kind of the villain, but not really. And I like that there's this almost playfulness between him and Waldo and Axel. You know, he's, like you say, he's the representative of the government, the authorities, the regulatory agencies, whatever.
Civil Aviation Authority or whatever it is at that time.
Trying to keep everybody safe and all that stuff. You know, so he's laying down the law. But at the same time, he's got a history with Waldo. You know, they know each other from previous experiences. So there's this kind of playful jabbing that they have at each other and, you know, appreciation for each other. But at the same time, he's got to do his job. And I thought that was a nice dynamic.
Yes. And you know, he's actually roots for Waldo. He's on Waldo's side, but he knows that Waldo is on the wrong side of the rules. And
yeah,
that's understandable. You know, it's a changing world, and like I said, this is one of those films that's about the way the world is changing over time. The whole idea of air travel, of people there's at one point when Waldo kind of accuses him. He says, "What are you going to do? Put highways in the sky for people?" And he says, "Yeah, that's exactly what we're going to do." And you know, you see the future coming right there.
I also want to bring up the actor that plays Ernst Kessler in the third act of the film, Bo Brundin. And I thought he was a great addition there in the third act. He's talked about through the whole movie, but we don't actually meet him until we get into the third act, where Waldo's now in Hollywood and he's being a stuntman, a stunt pilot. And he finally gets this actual face-to-face encounter with this notorious German pilot who he's been telling stories about as he goes out and tries to make money. And there's some really great moments that are just this actor, Bo Brundin, talking with Redford, and they're kind of sharing stories and sharing this appreciation for each other. And considering the fact that in the film leading up to this, we've had all these wild flying sequences and things like that. But here we get just these moments between these two characters that are just enthralling.
Yeah, no, it's really effective. And they do a lot of this non-verbally as well. It's
right.
Kind of like they both have this knowing look on their face, a smile that indicates, I know where you're coming from. I understand what's going on there. And when they get into the sequence at the end, the air battle that is supposed to be part of the film that they're making, that turns into something a lot more important to them. It's funny how it mirrors the very thing that we started off with, the story that Redford is talking about to the family and to all of the people who come out to see him fly. It's like the war story is being lived out in front of him right there. And the character is the person that he always suggested he was when it comes to his kind of chivalry and persona.
Well, let's talk about some of these flying sequences. Like we said at the top, George Roy Hill had experience as a flyer during a couple of different conflicts. He took to doing some of the flying himself for this film. And I mean, I'm not sure where to begin. There's a lot of standout moments here when it comes to just some things. I'll let Richard start by, you know, maybe giving some moments that stick out to him when it comes to the flying sequences. But I'll preface that by saying I was legitimately scared watching some of these sequences.
Well, first of all, they're doing all the sequences. These are not special effects. These are not something that this is not a process shot with a back screen that they're filming against. There's only one scene in the whole film that works that way. And it's just a very brief kind of exposition moment. Everything else that you're seeing, people actually did. The wing walking, the transfer between the planes, the grabbing a hold of the ladder and getting out of the car, all those kinds of things. Those are things that stunt pilots did, and they do in this particular film. George Roy Hill was fascinated with flying. He got his pilot's license when he was 16, so he was well prepared when it was time to, you know, volunteer for World War II and then return in Korea. He had been flying for a long time on those kinds of things. And he gets all the actors in the planes. I know that somebody wants to think that it's Redford doing the plane transfer. It's not, I'm sure. But Redford is in the plane for most of those shots. When they're filming him in the pilot seat, that's him flying in the air, you know, and it looks very realistic. I was mentioning something earlier that I thought was a little bit of a fault in the film, and maybe you'll disagree with me on this. I noticed that there is a very sparse soundtrack in this film, and all of those flying sequences have no musical accompaniment whatsoever. They all take place with just the noise of the airplane and the wind in the background, which I think is kind of understandable.
Yeah.
But I do think that audiences were sort of used to having an emotional cue given to us. And I'm not sure that we get as much out of those sequences as we ought to because of the absence of music. But they are pretty spectacular looking.
Yeah, you could be right there. I mean, the music where it is in the movie did grab me. I mean, it's Henry Mancini.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's some good stuff going on there. But I guess I was probably so caught up in just the danger that was there. I didn't even notice the lack of the music. But, yeah, I mean, it blew me away when you're looking at some of these shots and you're going, well, that's clearly not like a green screen or a blue screen type thing. And that's clearly Robert Redford there, you know, and that was wild. The one that got me, you know, especially, and you know, this will transition.
That's Sarandon on the wing.
Well, yeah, that was one where I was going, and you know, I'm sure there's trickery going on in certain ways,
oh, yeah.
You know, but at the same time, there are these shots, and you're looking out at the wing, and you're going, I'm pretty sure that's Susan Sarandon, and I see that ground moving, and I see that stuff, and I'm going, oh my gosh, that looks dangerous. I mean, like, you know, we're talking Tom Cruise Mission Impossible type of stuff here. You know, this is this is wild. But yeah, the shot that got me where I was going, oh my, I don't think you would have gotten me to do that, is Edward Herrmann. When we have these shots of him attempting the outside loop.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, we see him sitting in the cockpit. And again, you're going, that is definitely Edward Herrmann. And he is definitely in the real plane that is doing this. And, oh, my gosh, that ground looks like it's just about to scrape him across the forehead. And, I mean, it was nuts. I'm going, I don't think I would take that acting job.
Yeah, that would be one of those ones where I'd say, is there a good insurance policy on this? Because I might need it.
So, I mean, I was thoroughly impressed with the flying sequences. I think there was a lot of really intricate stuff there. And again, another way that I think this film takes you back. I mean, we actually get a far better angle of the danger that's going on here than people back in 1926 would watching it from the ground.
Yes.
It's very impressive and very dangerous looking. Not just dangerous looking, it is dangerous. And it's a joy to behold. So, yeah, before we start moving towards the break here, we mentioned that we would get into some spoiler territory. And you know, if we're talking about the danger, that's certainly where the spoilers come into play here, because, you know, those two scenes we just referenced there, where we're talking about first Susan Sarandon out on the wing of the plane and then Edward Herrmann doing the outside loop. Both of those scenes end tragically and caught me completely off guard. I mean, maybe it's my brain going, well, Susan Sarandon's a big star and all that. I mean, I have to remember she wasn't a big star yet in 1975. But to see her character, who, again, was my favorite character of the whole thing up to that point, exit the film
simply
so suddenly.
Slip off the wing and gone.
Yeah. And I was like, no, that didn't really happen. That didn't really happen. There was a parachute hidden somewhere. She landed in a hay bale. She can't really be gone. But no, that's what happens.
Yeah, and I think that's one of those things that changes the tone of the film so quickly, and you suddenly realize this is not quite the lighthearted adventure that I was thinking it was going to be, because there is going to be this dark cloud hanging over the film for the rest of the film, because we just lost a very likable character by these two guys doing something that they should have known a little bit better about. They should have practiced more. They should have thought about it ahead of time. I don't know. I can't say that I blame them, because who knows exactly how things would have gone if they had been doing it a little bit differently. But they, you know, Redford's character, of course, does jump into action. It's not as if he sat on the sidelines and didn't do anything to try and help. That's where you get one of the most dramatic scenes in the movie.
It's very impressive.
plane-to-plane transfer. And then he's on the wing trying to help her. And that's another one of those things that I think makes that sequence so dramatic, is because he is literally gone into the sky, jumped from one plane to another, crossed the wing, and is reaching his hand out to her, and it just... she just vanishes.
Yeah.
Just like that.
Yeah.
And you're suddenly going, whoa, I just went through all of that, and we still got a downer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, well, I don't think that's something that people expected at all.
And, I mean, part of what's so just heartbreaking about the whole thing is that, you know, well, like you said, she's an innocent. She's, you know, someone who's just kind of been tagging along with them, and because she's Axel's girl. And, you know, then in this moment when they're all trying to find out, well, how can we get more butts in the seats? You know, they hit on, you know, oh, well, you know, we need sex. We need the damsel in distress. Yeah. And she suddenly gets starstruck and she's like, oh, yes, I want my name up on the yeah. sign and this. And she gets so excited about it. And you're going, wait a minute. Have you ever even been in a plane, lady? And and then, you know, you keep on wanting, you know, Waldo or Axel to jump in and say, well, no, maybe, you know, let's think about this or whatever. But the next thing we know, they're doing it. And yeah, it does not go the way that I expected, for sure. But then, yeah, to just keep adding tragedy on, folks, then when we have a scene just a few moments later with the disastrous attempt at the outside loop, and Edward Herrmann meets tragedy, and, I mean,
it's bad enough that the plane crashes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the way in which he goes is just like, oh my gosh, how horrifying.
Well, and that scene is the one that really speaks to what you were talking about before, about, you know, the idea that, well, why do people go to see these flying circuses, these spectacles? Well, it's because of the danger. It's because they think they might see something terrible happen. And here something terrible happens, and they don't just sit and watch it. They run up to be a part of it, which causes more tragedy.
Right.
It's just, yeah. Oh, boy. Well, we should get moving to the break here, but I'll let you finish us off, Richard. Any final thoughts you have here on The Great Waldo Pepper?
The Great Waldo Pepper is a film that I remember very fondly. I enjoyed it immensely, but it isn't quite the lighthearted adventure comedy film that it might appear on the surface. The flying sequences are spectacular. Redford is great. By the way, I think one of the reasons he did these movies is because he just liked the hat. I swear he wore the same hat in The Sting, you know, that newsboy cap, you know, that just looked so jaunty on him during the film. I was also thinking about The Natural, which is set kind of in the same era.
Mm, yeah.
He just feels like a character that could really shine in that time period. And I haven't been the biggest fan of Redford's. I've liked him in plenty of films, but I would say those films where he is playing somebody in the past, in particular in that in the 20s and 30s, that's when he's been the best. I'm not sure why he fits there so well, but I thought he did.
You know, now that you mention that, I have never thought about it before, but I think you're absolutely right. I think the movies that jump out at me when I think about Robert Redford are these period pieces, are the ones where he's in this kind of the early part of the 20th century, you know, a different era, a different look. I think part of that is he looks like he belongs in that era. He looks like he could have been a film star back in the 20s. You know, he's got that kind of chiseled look to him. And so he fits perfectly, you know.
Recommendation from me.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is a fun film. You know, I say fun. It's got some tragic moments. You know, it like we said, it shifts tones and such. But I think there's a lot to really enjoy about this film. I love a film that takes me back to another era. You know, lets me experience something that I would never get to experience myself. And this film certainly does that. All right, we're going to take a quick break here. We'll hear from another Lamb Podcasting Network show, and then we'll be back with our recommendations here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
You'll save money and time. You'll get the best of merchandise and service when you patronize these good neighbors. Shop with them regularly for friendly service and money-saving values.
Hello, everyone. This is JD from the In Session Film Podcast. Each week, we review
the latest from Hollywood, California.
Well, yes, Brendan. We also
give top three lists.
Okay, yeah. Thanks again, Brendan. Additionally, you can hear us
talk other movie news, trailers, varying movie series, or other interesting film-related topics, and even rants and raves of the week.
That's correct, Brendan. On top of our main show, every Friday,
you can also hear our extra film podcasts.
Good job, Brendan.
Thank you, JD. It's my goal to make you proud. You're the father, after all.
Yes, and I'm very proud. You can listen to the In Session Film podcast on
iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or at InSessionFilm.com.
Brendan, will you please let me complete just one?
Nope.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Listen to the In Session Film podcast every Monday and Friday. Subscribe today and hear me verbally beat JD like a Cherokee drum.
No. That's not how this works, sir.
Hey,
no.
Go cry at Midnight Special again, okay? That's what you're good for.
I will. You know what? And I'll do it while pummeling you. I'll do both at the same time.
How are you going to pummel me? Yeah, I don't buy it.
Hi, everybody. This is Todd. Just a quick reminder that you can now help support the Forgotten Filmcast through Patreon. For just a few little old dollars a month, you can help support this show and earn access to some great bonus features in the process. Visit patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast to learn more.
As everyone knows, rainbows usually have a treasure at the end. Let's follow this one and see if we can find the pot of gold.
Brother, I suppose you've come to claim a treasure.
Well, we'd like to see the gold first.
Nathan, there's better than gold in here, me lad. No, just look here, no.
Candy, refreshing soft drinks, popcorn, ice cream. Well, that's some treasure, but anyone can buy luscious treats like these at the snack bar.
You don't tell me. Do you suppose you could get me a job as a snack bar attendant?
All right, welcome back. It's time for our movie recommendations. This is the part of the show where myself and my guest each get to share about another film that we've really enjoyed, something that we just want other folks to take a look at. It could be a forgotten film. It could be an old classic, something new at the theater, something on streaming, anything you want. So, Richard, what is your recommendation?
Well, my guess is that you'll be able to guess what it is as I slowly reveal things about it. It's a film set in the 1930s. It's about airplanes and air racing. It has great musical themes to it, and it features one of the most beautiful women in films ever. I'm going to be recommending The Rocketeer.
Oh, fantastic.
You know, we've been talking about a film where aerial antics are part of what's going on here. And The Rocketeer, people sometimes forget, because it's such an action-oriented film, that the whole point of The Rocketeer originally was that the hero, Cliff Secord, is a pilot who is involved in racing these speed planes across the country. They have a variety of competitions that they engage in. And another reason to recommend it is that it took place in Southern California, which in the 1930s and 40s was really the location where aviation was booming. All of the future giants of the aviation industry would be located in Southern California at some point or other. And there was a lot of that going on. And plus, we get the nostalgia feel of the era with the restaurants, with the planes that they're flying. There's also a flying circus that's in the story with the Rocketeer at one point, where we get a clown who is flying a plane dangerously, and there are potential accidents involved. So there's a nice connection here, and the Rocketeer is one of the great hero movies that deserved so much more than it got. I think it's finally remembered by people who have seen it and enjoyed it, and people who haven't, I don't know why you were hesitating on it, because it is one of the great pieces of entertainment that Disney produced in the early 90s.
Well, I agree completely. This is funny, because this is the first time this has ever happened, and you wouldn't have known this yet, Richard, because this episode has not released yet. But the episode prior to this one, I was joined by Bubba Wheat. We were talking about a superhero film called The Return of Captain Invincible, which stars Alan Arkin, who, of course, is in The Rocketeer. And so for my recommendation last week, I said, well, I got to recommend the other Alan Arkin superhero movie, and that's The Rocketeer.
Excellent. So
we get 2 weeks in a row of The Rocketeer, which is totally fine with me, because everything you said is true. I think The Rocketeer is fantastic. And, I mean, we talked about how George Roy Hill is a director who is able to very well capture
a past era and bring you back to that. And Joe Johnston, I think, is also that kind of director. I think that's why he was the right choice for the first Captain America film as well. He just has a knack for, you know, capturing an earlier era and transporting you back to that. And he certainly does that in The Rocketeer. And of course, I will never complain about, you know, having Jennifer Connelly films recommended on the show, because as we all know, she was my big high school crush. So
there you go. Yes. And of course we get James Bond playing Errol Flynn. How could I resist?
That's fantastic. Yes. Another movie that has a lot of great, colorful side characters in there. I always forget who is it who plays Howard Hughes in The Rocketeer. He's great too.
Oh, Terry O'Quinn. He's great.
Yes, fantastic. All right, well, the movie that I'm going to recommend fits in very well with The Rocketeer and the movie we talked about here today, Great Waldo Pepper. This is another film that focuses on a World War One flying ace, and this is one I just happened upon about a week or two ago. I watched it. This is before Richard and I decided we were going to talk about The Great Waldo Pepper on this show. So after I watched The Great Waldo Pepper, I was like, oh, well, I got to recommend this other movie that I literally just watched because I had a lot of fun with it. It's from 1983. It's a British film. It's called Bullshot. It's on the Criterion Channel right now. This stars an actor named Alan Shearman playing Captain Bullshot Crummond, which, of course, is a take on Bulldog Drummond. And he is a former World War One flying ace, also happens to be an Olympic champion, a race car driver, and a detective. So he gets called into service, to get into a case because his former wartime nemesis, Count Otto von Bruno, has returned and he has kidnapped a scientist who is working on a revolutionary new fuel. And of course, the scientist has a lovely daughter who is sweet on Bullshot. And it's, you know, it's got all those kind of standard adventure story elements to it. Bullshot, he's basically like part super spy, part Sherlock Holmes. And I would also say there's a bit of Frank Drebin to him as well, you know, where it's not quite the same type of humor as the Naked Gun series. It's kind of, you know, it borders on that. It's got this kind of outlandish comedy to it, but it's got a really sly, funny script, a lot of nods to classic adventure films and serials, just like Waldo Pepper. It's got some really cool aerial sequences to it, but then you've also got, you know, other adventure elements to there. Like there's a fight with a giant octopus and things like that. I guess it's based on a play. But, you know, it's not a movie that I sit there and watch and go, oh, well, this is clearly based on a play. No, this is very cinematic and you know, again, really rooted in, you know, being a comedy take on kind of those fun adventure movies and serials of like the 30s and 40s. So, you know, if you're into those type of films, you know, this is one that I think you'll really appreciate. And it's very funny as well. All right. Well, Richard, I want to thank you for being on the show. Before I let you go here, please remind everybody of where they can find all the projects you've got going on.
Well, all the projects that I do where I write are on my own site, Kirkham A Movie A Day. I have basically the same site on two different platforms. So the one that I use the most and has connections to everything is at kirkhamclass.blogspot.com. It's a WordPress. It's a blogger site from Google, and I've got links to all of my other projects there. And there's also, if you type in KirkhamAMovieAday.com, you'll get the WordPress site, which has the same content for the most part. It doesn't have all the links to the other projects as easily available to you. So the blogger site's a little bit easier. And, of course, every week you can go to the LAM site, which is largeassmovieblogs.com, and there find a link to the weekly podcast. And if you guys who are listening are interested and would like to be on the LAMcast, we'd love to have new guests. So you can contact me there, and I'd be happy to include you in our shows.
Yes, and I'll second that, too, just because, I mean, many moons ago, I mean, it's 10 years ago or so now that I started doing, blogging and podcasting stuff. And, you know, I was just doing it on my own type of a thing there. But, you know, what kind of pushed me to be able to do a podcast where I could actually have guests and things like that was because of the connections I made with other film lovers through the LAM, the Large Association of Movie Blogs. So I definitely encourage people to seek that out and make connections through there, because like I said up front, I've made a lot of great friends through that organization, Richard included. So, all right, well, I will be back here to close the show in just a moment here on the Forgotten Filmcast. Well, everybody, that brings us to the end of this episode of the Forgotten Filmcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to read more reviews of Forgotten Films, you can find them over at the Forgotten Films blog. That's at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. And you can like Forgotten Films at Facebook. I'd also love to hear your questions, comments, and feedback about the show. So you can please email me at forgottenfilmcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to visit our Patreon page, patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast, where you can learn more about how you can help support this show. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, go watch some old movies. We'll see you again real soon.
Guess I'm still alive. Me.
This podcast is a proud member of the LAM Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.